There's a lot written about Bill, and there's quite a bit. There's some written about Dr. Bob, but more about Wilson. He was the primary guy, the shaker that moved around. Dr. Bob was a very quiet fellow, really. And kind of reserved. I hear people talk about him. Bill was an idea minute man, and Dr. Bob was slow and easy, you know. Let's take it easy. Let's keep it simple, Bill, you know. One of the things I love is the guy that wants to keep it simple is the doctor. So we start off with Bill's story. War fever ran high in the New England town to which the new young officers from Plattsburgh were assigned. He has now gone, he's been in college, he's got a 2-year education, he is going to become a young lieutenant in the military. Young officer Plattsburgh that we were assigned, we were flattered with his social instinct. That's his social instinct. When the first citizenry took us into their home, first me and the rich folks, making us feel heroic. The more of that social instinct stuff. Here was love, applause, war, moments sublime, an integral hilarity. I was part of life at last. He is getting happy now. And in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. You know, isn't that exciting? I'm like him. I took my first drink when I was 19 years old, saying I'd never drink. His mother's family, his father and mother, were teetotalers. And you have to remember what's going on when did Prohibition come in? That's the crash.
No, that's the crash.
Yeah, Prohibition came in earlier than that, I think. I can't remember at the moment. But anyway, his mother's folks, his grandfather and his grandmother, they were anti-drinking.
1920 to 1933.
Thank you. There we go. So the mother's father, and prelude to that was the temperance movement. And so from his mother's side of the family, they were anti-booze. His father's side of the family owned an inn. And his grandfather on that side was a drunk. He had some sort of a spiritual experience and quit drinking. He had, his dad had brothers and they were all drinkers. And the general nature of the people were that they were good, hard-working people who probably liked to have a drink and cuss a little bit and tell the dirty story and maybe have a fist fight or something. But his mother's side of the family, his mother was very into the arts, that kind of stuff. Everybody in this little bitty town said it'll never work, and it didn't. So I forgot the strong warnings and prejudices of my people concerning drink. In time, we sailed for over there. I was very alone and again turned to alcohol. Through what? Through experience. Through success. It made him feel good. And he hadn't forgotten.
When I left home, I threatened to kill my stepdad. I was 19 years old in a minute. I'm lucky I'm not in prison. And, I came from a home where they got drunk and my mother lost the battle every time she's out of her weight class. But she'd try. And that went on for years. So anyway, he's saying that, I was very lonely and again turned to alcohol. Well, I used to do that. First time I took a drink was a group of boys in December of 1954. The model was Jack Daniels. Pretty important event if you remember that. I've slept with women, I don't remember their names. That's a pretty important event. So I visited Westminster Cathedral. He's doing the things in England that people do, just like anybody else. Much moved, I wandered outside, and my attention was caught by a dog on an old tombstone. Here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold small beer. A good soldier never forgot whether he died by musket or by pot. And though they're not talking about smoking pot, they're talking about drinking beer from a pot. His name was Thomas Thatcher, the guy. It's kind of just an interesting deal. Ebby Thatcher, Thomas Thatcher, just kind of an interesting deal, and that's where they came from, the Thatchers. Obvious warning, which I failed to heed. 22, and he's coming home now. The truth of it is that he ended up, he was in charge of cannons, and the Germans, there was a big flu epidemic, and they didn't want to send them overseas. They were in England getting ready to go into the war, and they kept them back because of the flu. They didn't want the flu to be transferred into the main army and cause more problems. So they had to wait a few months before they could go. So he's touring England and running around. And what he actually did was that they sent him into France, and he ended up in the high Alps of France with some cannons to cover the pass because they thought the Germans might try to escape over this little narrow pass. And a few cannons, you could cover that pass and keep them from getting through there pretty easy. Well, they never did come. So he spent a lot of time with the young ladies and in the French cellars drinking wine. And he was having a great time. So he really didn't see any real war. The nearest they ever come to getting hurt is some kind of a practice they were going through. And one of the shells almost got him, but he basically got through without a scratch. A veteran of foreign wars, I went home at last. I fancied myself a leader. Had not the men of my battery given me a special token of appreciation? Now he's going to take that. There's something wrong with this guy. He's going to take that little bit of somebody saying, oh, you're a great guy, and he's going to go right to my talents for leadership, I imagine, would place me at the head of vast enterprises, which I would manage with the utmost assurance. Now, wait a minute. I used to say when I was a kid, if they'd only let me be president of the United States, I'd straighten this world up right quick. You know. So he gets home, and he does exactly what a lot of people do that are in the military. He goes to live with her parents. He said, I took a night law course and obtained employment as an investigator for a surety company. He actually worked for a bank that's how he learned how to do Wall Street. He worked for a bank that loaned money to businesses, and when these businesses went broke, they didn't want to make the same mistake again, and that's what he was. He was a trained investigator for these banks to go out and investigate why the business went broke that they loaned money to that looked so good. Does that make sense? That's what he was really doing. And the drive for success was on. I proved to the world I was important. My work took me about Wall Street, and little by little I became interested in the market. Many people lost money, but some became very rich. Why not I? I studied economics and business as well as law. He worked, when he first got home, he worked out on the docks driving spikes, building wharfs. And he's a smart guy, this guy. He really is. He just can't keep it together long enough to get anywhere with it. And so he goes to the Brooklyn Law School at night. That's typical of guys coming home from the service. You know, we got a GI Bill, and when we got the GI Bill, a lot of guys went to school with the GI Bill. You know, it was a good deal. I went 3 times and never could make it. I told you I failed everything I ever did. And I decided I was too smart for college education anyway. So many people lost money, but some became rich. Why not I? Here's an ego, and he believes he's just smarter than most people are losing money, but some got rich. Why not me? Why can't I be one of those guys, you know? I studied economics and business as well as law. Potential alcoholic I was, I nearly failed my law course. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or write. Though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wife. We're having trouble here. Alcohol is causing him trouble. It's causing him trouble at school. It's causing him trouble at home. But I love this guy. He is a salesman. We had long talks when I would steal her foreboding by telling her that men of genius could see their best projects when drunk. That makes me think of the guy that was the old painter that cut his ear off and gave it to a prostitute who was an addict and an alcoholic. That the most majestic construction of philosophic thought was so derived. And she bought it. I can't believe that. My wife wasn't that dumb.
This is in 1922 now.
Right.
All right. So Judge has been drinking 5 years.
Yeah, he's slowed down.
He's already, you know, from 1980, when he turned 21 years old, went to war in 1918, now this is 1922. So in that space of time, he's already got trouble with the wife. And he's not showing up for steps. He's too drunk to do it.
By the time I completed the course, I knew the law was not for me. Now, what do you think about that? The guy goes to law school at night, completes the course, finally gets through school, don't want to be a lawyer anymore. I want to be a stockbroker. I want to go make more money. See? So, forget law. He never got his certificate because he wouldn't go back and walk across the stage and take his diploma. And it was part of the requirement of the school. So finally, when he became famous in anonymity, they said, we want to give you your diploma. And he, I don't know why he didn't take it, but he didn't. You don't have to come back and walk. We'll just give it to you. Make him an honorary doctor's degree. He had a lot of things that he turned away. The inviting maelstrom of Wall Street had me in his grip. Business and financial leaders were my heroes. They were his gods. They were his gods. And they're going to remain his gods. And they're going to remain even after sobriety and after long sobriety. He has trouble. And part of that trouble was, and he's going to tell, I'll tell you about it when we get to it. And he'll tell you about it. So, he goes on and he says, out of this alloy of drink and speculation, I commenced to forge the weapon that one day would turn in flight like a boomerang and almost cut me to ribbons. Living modestly, my wife and I saved $1,000. This guy's a little bit like an inside trader, if you get the idea, which was not illegal at the time. I went into certain securities and then cheap and rather unpopular. I rightly imagined that they would someday have a great rise. I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories and management, but my wife and I decided to go anyway. I developed a theory that most people lost money in stocks through ignorance of the market. I discovered many more reasons later on. Boy, did he. He died owing his family money. He was still making payments on the money he owed him on some things he got him into. Since we gave up the positions and off we roared on a motorcycle, the boss was trained as a school teacher and worked for an aunt that had a private school. The sidecar stuff was tents, blankets, a change of clothes, and three huge volumes of financial reference services. This was 4/25 of 25. In other words, April the 25th of 1925, they set off on this adventure. And Lois would go anywhere with him because when they changed his environment, they changed his drinking. Does that make sense? So she was willing to go in. They were great hikers. They helped build the Adirondack trails. They would go walking 200 and 300 miles. They would stay overnight. They camped. They did a lot of things. And they had a farm that belonged to the brother-in-law. And they would go out there and it would change. Bill would stop drinking or he would slow down and he would get active into other things. And so she was willing to go anywhere with him. Even on this motorcycle trip. Our friend thought a lunacy commission should be appointed. Perhaps they were right. I had some success in speculation, so we had a little money. But we once worked on a farm for a month to avoid drawing on our small capital. That farm was called the Goldfoot Farm. And they did such a good job, a year after they came back, the Goldfoot wrote them and asked them to come back. It said, look at his line. That was the last honest manual labor on my part for many a day. We covered the whole eastern United States in a year, and at the end of it, my report to Wall Street secured me a position there in the use of a large expense account. What he did is he went out, and one of the examples that he did is he would try to get into these, they'd buy stock in these companies, so you could say you were a part owner of the company. And then he could go in and say, I want to look the place over, and they'd show him around. Well, he got to GE. Now, we know what GE is today. Well, GE in those days was a pretty small company. And so he goes down to the local bar where the GE people who are in research hang out. It's a big secret, right? And so he talks to them, and he's from New York, and he's with the stock market, and he's a big shot. And, of course, they start this stuff talking to these guys. And they said, well, yes. Come on down, we'll show you a few things that we're doing, big shot. And so they took him down and, of course, exposed him to all their secret stuff. Well, one of the secret stuff was the GE toaster. Most of you are not old enough to remember when they used to put a bread between a folding kind of deal like this that was all cut up, a little wire thing, and you'd hold it over turn it back and forth over the fireplace and take it out, and that was your toast. So G.E. Toaster, at a reasonable cost, was going to sell, and he knew that. So that's what he would write up in his reports back to the people back east, and he'd say, buy, 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 you know. This is going big, see. So he's an inside trader. He's getting the information from the inside, passing it on to the people. He's making people millions of dollars. And he's making a lot of money. So it said here, the use of a large expense account. They gave him a lot of shoeshine money, and they gave him this big expense account so he could invest in the deals he put together. If you're not willing to buy stock in the deal you're putting together, it must not be a very good deal. Well, they gave him a $20,000 credit. That's about $2 million in today's money. And that's a lot of credit. Because, you see, his boss had a credit line with the stock exchange. And he gave him $20,000 worth that he could go work with on these deals. And he said the exercise with Austin brought in more money, leaving us with a profit of several thousand dollars for that year. That's big money. The working man's not making much. Lois at one time made $72 a month. Does that give you any idea what a couple of thousand looks like? For the next few years, fortune threw money called security instinct and applause called social instinct. We have three instincts, social, security, and sex. I had arrived. You betcha. Man, he's got her made now. He is rolling. They have got this apartment they've got. They've now rented the apartment next door. They've knocked out the wall. They have to put up a deposit that says they put the wall back with it. They have a grand piano. They are entertaining in tux and formal dresses. They're rolling and moving with the shakers, and money is flying out of the woodwork. My judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tunes of what? Paper million. Stocks. Not cash. Stocks. The great boom of the late 20s was seething and swelling. Drink was taking an important and exhilarating place in my life. Oh, boy. In other words, I'm uptown now. You know, I'm not drinking down in the bad place. I'm uptown in the big places, man. I'm hitting it with the big folks. There was a loud talk in the jazz places uptown. Everyone spending thousands, scattered in millions. Scoffers could scoff and be damned. I made a host of fair weather friends. Now, I know what that means, right? You ever have any fair weather friends? You know? Get sober and see what happens. Well, them drunks disappear like crazy. They talk about you down at the bar, you know. The drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. He liked to fight when he's drunk. He's very argumentative. He's a Jekyll and a Hyde, like the book describes him. And there are many unhappy scenes in our scrumptious apartment. In other words, we got it all, and we're fighting. Does that make sense? We've got it all, and we're fighting, you know. There had been no real infidelity for loyalty to my wife. Helped by times, extreme drunkenness kept me out of those straits. In 1929, I contacted Gulf Fever. I went at once to the country, my wife to applaud, while I started out to overtake Walker Hagen. Walker Hagen was the world's best golfer from 1914 to 1929, and the ego of Bill is that I can be the top dog. He's always been trying to be the top dog. Victor caught up with me much faster than I came up behind Walter. It's caused him a little trouble. I began to be jittery in the morning. Anybody ever remember that? Little hair of the dog that bit you? Oh, boy. What do you do when you hit the bed and it's spinning? Get a foot on the floor. All right. I like drunk. Real drunk. There, boy. Get a foot on the floor. How many people here had their bag all fixed to puke in? Oh yeah, I had that. Get that right there, but gotta have that ready to go. Golf permitted drinking. I love that. Golf permitted drinking. What it was socially acceptable. Every day and every night. It was fun to carry him around the exclusive course, which I had inspired much awe in me as a lad. That's the one up in Manchester that Uncle George had built. I acquired an impeccable coat of tan one season upon the well-to-do. The local banker watched me whirl fat checks in and out of the till. His till was amused skepticism. Abruptly in October 1929, hell broke loose on the New York Stock Exchange. After one of those days of inferno, I wobbled from a hotel bar to a brokerage office. It was 8 o'clock, 5 hours after the market had closed. The ticker still chattered. I was staring at an inch of tape which bore the inscription XYZ32. It had been 52 that morning. If you know how that works, you got to be able to cover it or lose. And he couldn't cover it. And now he's trying to peddle it off and he can't. That stock, he had good instincts. That stock was called Pinnock and Ford. Can you imagine, as you owned some Ford stock in those days, what it would be worth today? Woo! And Pinnock was a big outfit. I was finished, and so were many friends. The papers reported men jumping to the death from ties of high finance. That disgusted me, he says. I love that, boy. I would not jump. I went back to the bar. My friends had dropped several million since 10 o'clock, so what? He's sitting there drinking. He gets that ease and comfort. The anxiety's gone, and he says, tomorrow's another day. As I drank, the old fierce determination to win came back. Next morning, I telephoned a friend in Montreal. This guy's name was Richard Johnson. The crash did not catch up with Canada for 3 years. After the 29 crash, it didn't come to them until 32. So he said he had plenty of money left. I thought I'd better go to Canada. By the following spring, we were living in our accustomed style. I felt like Napoleon returning from Elba. No St. Helena for me. But drinking caught up to me again, and my generous friend had to let me go. And this time we stayed broke. Was no comeback. I let my stepdad convince me that I ought to come to Dallas, Texas. I was married. I had joined the Mormon church. I had been able to stop drinking in about 3.5 years. And he said, you got these kids. And in inventory, you see, it really, I have to take the truth. He didn't convince me of nothing. What I heard was money. And he was an independent insurance adjuster, and he made lots of money. And he said, you ought to come back here and get in the insurance business with me, and you'll make a lot of money. But I go back to Dallas. I take my two kids at the time and my wife. And we had a house in California. We were doing okay. I worked in children's home for a long time. And we were doing just fine. And I go back there, and we get lucky. And we have a big storm in Dallas, big hailstorm and a tornado. And that's the kind of work we did. Go out and measure roofs and turn in reports and, you know, get people to sign the thing, send it into company. You make $100 a roof if there's any kind of damage at all. It wasn't by how much. If there was no damage, it was $15. In those days, $15 was more than most work. Oh, they made it, made $25 a day, but I climbed two roofs to make as much as a working guy was making. And as I worked at the First National Bank in Oklahoma City when I was a kid, and so I'm in to drop a check in, which reminds me of this story, and it's a big check. And the lady on the other end of the counter, the other end of the cashier said to me, she says, do you remember me? And I looked at her and I said, give me a clue. She said, you and I worked at the First National Bank in Oklahoma City. And I said, well, you were the head check sorter. She said, yeah, that's right. You do remember. She said, my God, if you don't mind me asking what you do, Don, what do you do? And I said, I'm an independent insurance adjuster. She says, holy, the banker would like to meet you. And right away, man, you know, I get this ego, you know. The bank, I don't know jack, nothing. I told you I'm dumb. I don't know nothing. So I go over and meet the banker, and he says, are you in the red book, Mr. Brown, or are you in the blue book? Which was a credit line is what it was. I didn't know what it was. I said, what's the difference? He said, about $25,000. I said, I'll take the $25,000. So he gave me a credit line. And he said, is there anything we can do for you? And I said, well, I've been looking at cars. And he said, we've got cars, good cars. Sometimes we, what kind are you looking for? And I said, I like a station wagon with a rack on top. I got to carry ladders around. He said, we got one. Just beautiful. Sign the paperwork. No problem. Out the door I go with a Ford car that's almost brand new. Man, life is great. 1 year later, the bank guard wouldn't even let me in the bank. That's how long it took me to go through all that money and down to the bottom. Like, oh, Lord. I walked the streets of Dallas in a three-piece suit, thinking that I wasn't on the bottom, you know. It was horrible. My family's gone there. Oh, Jesus Christ. It was really bad. My stepdad gave me $50 and bought me a bus ticket. Don't show what kind of a drunk I am. I started an AC-DC game in the back of the bus to con these guys out of their dough. I beat them out of about $120 to go with the $50 that he gave me plus the ticket. I am so bad off. By the time I get to Santa Fe, New Mexico, they won't let me on the bus. I go off and buy. I feel bad, but not feel bad. I just don't want to get mad. So I take them off and feed them some dinner, and we come back, and they let everybody on the bus but me. And the driver says, if that big bastard gets on this bus, I ain't driving it. Now, I want you to understand that I've been everything in my life but what I am, and I start talking about I'm a lawyer and I'm going to sue you. I don't know how you can get in so much trouble doing nothing. Anyway. Guy said, don't worry about it. The next bus through is a straight through bus. You'll be to Los Angeles quicker than, you know, oh, Jesus. I left there and I went and took me a job with some relatives who had to hire me and, or live with me for $16 a day. And it was house moving. And oh, man, I weighed about like I do now and they worked it right off of me. Anyways, Jesus. And my first sponsor said, you'll screw up a one-car funeral, kid. It's true. So he goes to Canada, and this time she is mad at him. They have a Packard car, because Packards are the big car of the day. They have a huge, nice apartment, and he drinks his way right out of this job. And she gets enough money and gets on the train, and she says, you clean up the mess. I'm not cleaning up after you no more. And she goes home to Mom and Daddy. He cannot get out of town because he don't have any money. So he gets rid of the Packard, and he gets rid of the apartment. Then he goes to this guy, Johnson, and they're so disgusted with him. He had an insurance policy, and they loaned him some money on the policy. And that's how he got out of town and got back home. Now, you can believe me how welcome you would be if you had a son-in-law like that coming to live with you. We went to live with my wife's parents, naturally. I don't know why I wrote this in, just some of my research. Her name was Spellman, her maiden name was. I found a job, and then lost it as a result of a brawl with a taxi driver. Mostly no one could guess I would have no real employment for 5 years. I hardly draw a sober breath. Her dad was a doctor, Dr. Burningham. Hated Bill. She was the oldest daughter. They were three girls and two boys. Two of them would become doctors. All of them were college educated. Her mother died from cancer. There's a little scandal because the good doctor was kind of sporting a woman before Mama died. But he hated, his oldest daughter was his favorite. And Lois was his favorite. And he just hated Bill. Now towards the end, though, he began to cooperate and he began to give him sedatives and things of that nature. My wife began to work in a department store, coming home exhausted to find me drunk. She worked for Macy's. And she sold tables that the legs unfolded, called bridge tables. You probably see those around. Well, boy, in those days, they were a brand new item. Everybody wanted one because you could fold it up and put it in the closet and do it. And everybody played these games and the great card table. But she made $72 a month doing it. And she's supporting them. Dad has moved out. Mama's died. This is going to be down here. But I became an unwelcome hanger-on at the brokerage places. It's causing trouble. They don't want him around anymore. The fair-haired boy is no longer fair-haired. They don't want him anymore. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. I like that. It became a necessity, and I can guarantee you my liquor became a necessity. Bathtub, gin, two bottles a day in Austin Street got to be routine. This is all this guy did, was gather up booze. Wife worked, and he gathered up booze. That was his sole job, to make sure that he had enough booze to get through the next 24 hours. He'd been living 24 hours at a time. Sometimes a small deal would net a few $100s. He had always made big money. He knew how to turn big money, and once in a while he'd come up a little stuff and go make some money. I'd pay my bills at the bars and delicatessen. But when he didn't have money, how's he drinking? On credit. How many people here run a tab at the bar? Aha. Which bill did you pay first? The bar or the grocery bill? Take care of that bar bill, man, first, right? I paid my bills at the bars and delicatessen. This went on endlessly, and I began to waken very early in the morning, shaking violently. Have you ever shook violently? I shook violently. I know what'll fix it, though. So he goes on, a ton before the gin followed by half a dozen bottles of beer would be required if I were to eat any breakfast. Nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation. He believes he can control this thing. I can stop anytime I want to. Right? Just don't want it. There were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope. So somewhere within him, like in every alcoholic, when their lives are threatened, he feels threatened. He don't know what it's coming from. It's instinctual behavior. He feels threatened and he tries to quit. He's going to control it. Anybody here ever try to control it? Wow. Gradually things got worse. It's a progressive disease. The house was taken over by the mortgage holder. My mother-in-law died and my wife and father-in-law became ill. The mother-in-law was really supportive. She was very loving and kind. And she kept saying, give him a chance. Give him a chance. He's a good guy. Give him a chance. And this guy couldn't even make it to the funeral. He could not even honor that poor woman's death who had defended him and that family. Probably lucky he didn't get to the funeral. He would have been a horse's ass when he got there, probably. Then I got a promising business opportunity. Stock were at a low point in 1932, and I'd somehow formed a group to buy. I was to share generously in the profits when I went on a prestigious dinner in that tennis bandage that's called the famous Applejack story. And he was told by a group of investors, this is a perfect deal for you, Bill. You see it through. I'm going to give you some engineers. Go ahead and check this company out. If everything flies, you're going to make some real money. And he just could not say so. And the next day they got up and went on into their own investigation. And he couldn't even get up to do it. I woke up. I love this. I woke up. This had to stop. I saw I could not take as much as one drink. He knows about one drink. Can't take as much as one. I was sued forever, he says. Before then I'd written lots of sweet promises, but my wife hadn't observed this time I meant business. And so I did. And he means that. See, this guy's got tremendous willpower. This is probably the only thing in his life that's ever beat him up. Probably the only thing he couldn't whip. So, in this case, Bill was a little different than me. I never wrote anything down that she could quote from. He wrote it in the Bible. Solemn oath in the Bible. From your loving husband. I will never drink from this day on. Promise, date it, sign it, and shoot. But my wife had observed it, so I did. Shortly afterwards, I came home drunk. I love that. All that talk, and I'm home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone that pushed a drink my way, I'd taken it, was I crazy? He now begins to believe that he's crazy. We begin to diagnose ourselves, and it makes sense, am I crazy? And he begins to accept that I'm crazy. He says, renewing my resolve, which is his will, I try it again. Some time passed, and confidence began to be replaced by cocksuredness. I could laugh at the gin mill. So he gets a little time in. See? Now I had what it takes. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time I was beating on the bar asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I'd manage better next time. But what's happened now? The phenomenon of craving has come in. But I might as well get good and drunk. And I did. Once the phenomenon of craving set in on him, he's gone. And many of the times, I understood that from experience. Many of the time I stopped with the boys at work to have a Boilermaker. Some of the old timers drank Boilermaker. I thought it was a big time guy. I drank that Boilermaker with them. They got up and went home. And I'd meet the afternoon crew when it came in at 11 o'clock that night. I couldn't get off the bar stool. It was about 30 minutes from where I lived to where I worked. And my wife must have thought it was 200 miles. And I would stop and take grease off of my truck and put it on my hands, and I'd walk in and say, you'll never believe this, honey. These two old white-headed ladies was out there in the dark, and I scared to death, and I just couldn't leave them. They were out of gas, you know. And then I found a little problem in here. Oh, Jesus. That poor woman. God bless her. She's still alive. I don't know how. I broke her heart. We're good friends today, though. My amends have been made. The remorse and horrors of the hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. He couldn't even fight back anymore. He couldn't even see. One day I could get 28 days on guts years ago. The wife would get on me. I said, I'm not like my folks. I'm not drunk like them. I can quit drinking anytime I want. I tell you what I'll do, honey. I'll do a limp like the people Catholics. I don't know what limp thought. You know, what do I know? But the people next door were Catholics, and they did Lent, and they'd give something up. And I said, I give up drinking for 30 days. I could never get 30 days. I could get 28. And then I'd say, you see there, I'm not an alcoholic. No real alcoholic like my parents could ever get that kind of time. I'll be back in just a minute, and I'd go down and restock the bar. So he said, my brain raced uncontrollably. It was a terrible sense of impending calamity. I hardly dare cross the street. His body is surrendering to this disease. Thus I collapsed and run down by the early morning truck. I guarantee you how to lose weight. When I came into the program, I was 70 pounds underweight. I didn't even know it. You drink alcohol and nothing but alcohol, I guarantee you, you'll lose weight. But I'd read the side of the can. I knew what was in that beer, man. It had food value. Who needs food, you know? It was scarcely daylight, he said. My withering nerves were still at last, the hair of the dog that bit him. The morning paper told me the market had gone to hell again. Well, so had I. The market would recover, but I wouldn't. It was a hard thought. Oh, now it's down to it. Before, he thought people had jumped from high buildings were nuts. But now he is at a place that says, should I kill myself? No, not now. Then a mental fog settled down. Jim would fix that. Two bottles and oblivion. He's passing out. If you don't know anything about that drinking, I hope you never find out. I've been there. I know what that's about. Drink, say I'm not going to drink, pass out, come to, fight for 15 minutes, take another drink, puke a little, take another drink till it stays, drink my way to pass out and come to. First thing you do on a wet 12-step call is you ask, how long has this person been drinking this way? If it's 6 days, 5 days, 8 days, 10 days, don't worry about it. I say when he hits about 10 days, he'll be ready to go do something. Give me a call. 14 days is as much as you can even get in a laboratory. You can't stay drunk all the time. Oblivion. I drank to pass out because it was the only way I could get any kind of rest. That make sense? Completely out. You could have operated on me. I wasn't waking up. I'm coming to. And there's a difference. The mind and the body are marvelous mechanisms. For mine endured this agony 2 more years. Sometimes I stole from my wife's slender purse. All this guy had made all this money. Now I have to steal from this woman. They used to steal from me when the morning terrors of madness were on me. Again, I swayed dizzily before an open window in the medicine cabinet where they were poisoned, cursing myself for a weakling. He wants to jump out the window and die. And I didn't know anything about this house for a long time, but I thought, it's got a full basement, and it comes up halfway out of the ground, got half windows, and goes 3 stories up, so he's up pretty high. There were flights from city to county and back as my wife and I saw it escape. We call those what? Geographics. Except the problem was, Bill, he'd take the Bill with you. That's the problem. Then came the night when the physical and mental torture was so hellish I feared I would burst through my window sash and all. Somehow I managed to drag my mattress to the lower floor, at least I suddenly leaped. The doctor came with a heavy sedative. The doctor's name was Leonard Strong. It's Bill's sister's husband, who was a doctor. And they know each other through his mother. They went to the same medical school. Leonard Strong is a wonderful man. And he will stay with Bill right through this whole deal. He's the guy that led him to Rockefeller. He was forever there to help him, and they'd use laudanum. Laudanum is one of the strongest drugs known to man, and they'd knock Bill out. He didn't bring his mattress down. He didn't know how it got down there. He's in a blackout. They drug it down there so he couldn't jump out the window. Can you imagine living with this nut? Can you imagine this guy running around upstairs in the bathroom, crashing, looking for stuff to drink? I'm going to kill myself. I'm going to run and jump out the window. Lois, I bet you can get a lot of sleep, right? And she's got to go to work. So she'd call this guy and he'd just knock him out. Next day, he found me drinking both gin and sedative. What do we call that? We call that dual addiction. Hold it. One of the co-founders drank, took gin and sedative? You got to be kidding. Couldn't happen, right? This combination soon landed me on the rock. Drugs are all through this book. I don't know where people get this idea. They're looking for the pure alcoholic. So people feared we wouldn't have much of a society today if we're looking for pure alcoholics, would we? I go to a young people's meeting when I can. I haven't been down in quite a while. It's a huge meeting. They are solid in the solution. They will have an altar call which says those who have worked the steps put up your hands and want a sponsor, and those who need a sponsor, and they jump on them in a minute, man, and they work those steps with them, and they hang on to them. They do a wonderful job. They're one of the best 12-step groups I know of. And you walk in there, and you'll see a 14-year-old or a 16-year-old or an 18-year-old. I was just getting warmed up at 19. Does that make sense to you? Jesus. People feared for my sanity. Sure they did. Dr. Silkworth has got the paperwork made out. Wants Lois to sign it. She won't do it. He's saying to her, you know something. He's young. He's 30-some years old. Let's put him in an institution and protect himself against him and maybe the people down where they do the laboratory work and discover the new medicines will be able to figure out something for him. But this way, he's going to die. She wouldn't do it. People feared my son, so did I. I could eat little or nothing when drinking. I was 40 pounds underweight, and when you make a 12-step call, the first thing I look for is weight loss. First thing I look for. How long have you been drinking this way, and what's the weight loss? Then I got to determine what we're going to do next. You have to have a plan of action. You just can't go call on them. You got to be able to do something, particularly if they'll move. We're losing our detox centers down in the Bay Area, and I've been praying that they'll come back, but we're losing them. And it's a horrible thing. I don't want to get off into it, but they're closing them down for lack of funding. Thousands of people that will be going through detox, and all people that go to detox don't want to get sober. But just to have them, it's like a resting place for them, you know. And people that are losing great weight loss are dying. And they don't even know they're dying. My brother-in-law is a physician, and through his kindness and that of my mother, I was placed in a nationally known hospital for mental and physical rehabilitation, Charles B. Towns Hospital. It was $700 for 7 days. $100 a day. That's big money in those days. Under the so-called belladonna treatment, my brain cleared. Now also, and Lois in her new book says that she got money from her brother. Also, they were doctors. She got money from them. Brain cleared. Hydrotherapy and mild exercise. That's water. Take a shower. Light sprays, you know. You're paying big money for this. Mild exercise helped much. Best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained that though certainly selfish and foolish, I've been seriously ill, bodily and mentally, the obsession and the allergy. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in the alcoholic, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, but it often remains strong in other respects. That's why we drive doctors crazy. Because we're, like the thing he read that Dr. Silkworth wrote, that we are really human beings. We have a tendency here to blame everything on alcohol. And all human beings are selfish and self-centered. And the quicker you can help your person get back over to, I'm really a part of the human race instead of this, we use alcoholism to, like a thing to beat ourselves up with. My incredible behavior in the face of desperate desire to stop was explained. Now he's going to self-knowledge. He's got it now. He understands the problem. I got this allergy and I got this obsession and that's why I can't drink and I got some self-knowledge. And I can handle it now. When you talk to alcoholics, you're talking depth and weight. What do you talk to depth and weight? If I make a 12-step call on you, I'm going to start telling you, how do you make a 12-step? Anybody know here? Whose story do you tell on the first time round? Your story. And as you tell them the story, you throw in this doctor's opinion. And you lay it on hard. I thought I was nuts. I thought I was this until I got to an understanding from a doctor that I had an obsession of the mind and an allergy of the body. What happens if the guy relapses? Then what happens? Who tells what story? He tells you. We'll find out some more about this as we go. I ferried forth in high hope for 3 or 4 months. The goose hung high. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. But it was not, for the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and body health fell off like a ski jump. This is July in the summer of 1934. After a time, I returned to the hospital. Why? He's in the four walls. He knows by experience he won't drink in that hospital. He has no trust in himself outside of that hospital. And so he goes there. This was the finish. Curtains, it seemed to me. My wearying and despairing wife was informed that it would all end in heart failure during delirium tremors, that I would develop a wet brain perhaps within a year. She would soon have to give me over to the undertaker of the asylum. That's the choice. And the doctor said, let's sign him up. Let's put him in the nut house for us. And we'll keep him there like we do a lot of other people. And we'll protect him from him. And maybe they'll develop something. But, I mean, that's our only choice, Lord. She wouldn't do it. He says, they did not need to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. He wants the madness to stop. And he doesn't have the guts to kill himself. I wanted the madness to stop. How many people here ever found incomprehensible demoralization? Thank you. It's part of the process to find bottom. I hate to tell you, it's a necessity. Do not prevent people from finding it. This is a disease in which you've got to let them go to the bottom. It's very painful if you sponsor people and you watch them go and there's nothing you can do about it. It just drives you crazy. It makes me cry is what it does. They did not tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. I want to drop back to Dr. Silver for a minute. How would you like to go to work every day and treat 100 patients and have success with 2? And you're going to sit in your office and you're going to talk to 98 family members and you're going to say, I'm sorry. I've done everything I can. We have got to give them to the insane asylum, to the undertaker of the asylum. Now you're going to have to make a choice. Do you think you could take that very long? I mean, if I didn't have some success at the work I do, I wouldn't do it. Does that make sense? But this guy's grinding it out day in, day out, man. 98 out of every 100, he's going to sit down and tell them that same thing. I've got bad news. Have you ever been in a position where you carry bad news to people? Ooh, that's hard stuff. That's hard. So he welcomes the idea. He's ready to die. He's living in step one. That he's powerless over alcohol. And he knows it. It was a devastating blow to my pride, which is really his ego. Isn't that nice? I love it. I, who had thought so well of myself and my abilities and my capacities to surmount obstacles, was cornered at last. He gives up. I'm cornered. He recognized, I'm done. Now is the plunge into the dark, joining the endless possession of thoughts who had gone on before. I'm going to the bridges. I'm going to eat out of garbage cans. He's not stupid. I'm going down. And there's nothing I can do about it. It's called incomprehensible demoralization. I thought of my poor wife, he says. There'd been much happiness after all. What would I not give to make amends? But that was over now. He said, she's had all she can stand. I mean, he just can't stop. It's over. And when I went through treatment, I read this line right here. This line struck me right to the core of my being. No words could tell the loneliness, despair I felt in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I'd met my match. I'd been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. And I know exactly how that feels. It's step one. He knows that he is powerless, he is hopeless, and he is helpless to do anything about it.
Therefore, I'm just going to join the regular stops and go right on down to the Tenderloin. I'm headed down to wherever they go. Wherever alcoholics go, that's where I'm going.
Trembling, I stepped in the hospital, a broken man. Fear sobered me a bit. I've seen this many times, people coming out of the hospital, not drinking on fear. They came, the insidious insanity of that first drink. At an armistice day in 1934, I was off again. Everybody became resigned to the certainty I had to be shut up somewhere or stumble along to a miserable end. I'm going to the nut house or death. His families give up on me. How dark it is before the dawn. In reality, that was the beginning of my last debauch. I was soon to be catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. That's 10, 11, and 12. We'll get around to how you get there in a minute. Well, probably not today. I was to know happiness. These are promises, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is describably more wonderful as time passes. This time he starts drinking on November the 11th, and he drinks for 3 weeks because the disease is progressive, and it's getting closer and closer and closer. He can't fight it off. Get the picture? And he can only go so long before he's down again, see? So he said, near the end of that bleak November, I sat drinking in my kitchen with a certain satisfaction. I reflected there was enough gin concealed about the house to carry me about through that night to the next day. My wife was at work. I wondered whether I'd dare hide a full bottle of gin near the head of our bed. I'd need it before daylight. You get that? I would need it. Not want it. Need it. There's a difference. My musing was interrupted by the telephone. Telephone musing is just daydreaming about what life might want to be. Fall of 1934. The cheery voice of an old school friend asked if he might come over. Ebby. Ebby is working at the Calvary Mission doing service. The one that Sam Shoemaker's church owns. He was sober. I mean, just for him to say that, it's in italicized words, just for him to say that indicates that he's a little surprised. So he goes, it was years since I could remember his coming to New York in that condition. I was amazed. Rumor had it he'd been committed for alcoholic insanity. I wonder how he'd escaped. Of course he would have dinner and then I could drink openly with him. Unmindful of his welfare. Think of that. Think about the fact if you were sitting somewhere and a friend called and the rumors had it that he had been committed for alcoholic insanity to a nut house. And you're so self-centered and so uncaring that you're not even concerned with it. It's what you can get out of it. You know? So he said, I thought only of recapturing the spirit of other days. When drinking was fun, when they were doing things that was great fun. They were the fair-haired boys of this little town of Manchester and Bill's hometown, and they kind of made it. Manchester got an airport, and they heard about it, and they got this guy, Ebby knew a guy that had an airplane and flew him in there. They were in pretty bad shape. They had the band out. The fair-haired boys were drunk. Fact is, he didn't even let them off in front of the band. He packed them into the hangar where they got out and fell on the floor and puked. There was a time we'd chartered an airplane to complete a jag. His coming was an oasis in this dreary desert of futility. He's describing the bottom. It's just brutal. I get up every day. I drink at night. I don't want to. I can't quit. I've accepted this is the way it is. I'm done. It's just a matter of time. Something bad's going to happen. I begin to have a lot of fear. I begin to have this, we get these, voices and, you know, we get to do a lot of thinking and, you know. The very thing in OS is drinkers are like that. It's a feeling. The door opened and he stood there fresh skinned and glowing. Bill could not spit that hook. Bill knew this guy well. He could not spit that hook. He is fresh skinned and glowing. There is something about his eyes
We're talking about transformation. This guy is not the same guy. My sponsor says that if the steps are carefully taken, they will burn the old man into a pile of ashes, and upon those ashes will arise a brand new spiritual being who's never been here before. We're talking about transformation here. Serious business. There was something about his eyes. He was implicitly different. And it made an automatic question. What had happened? It's all going through Bill's head. What had happened? Something's different. I pushed a drink across the table. He refused it. Disappointed but curious, I wondered what had got into the fellow. He wasn't himself. Come, what's this all about? I queried. He looked straight at me, smiling, simply but smiling, and said, I've got religion. He's getting ready to bring to Bill the Oxford Group religious message. Okay? Because that's all he has to carry. AA's not around. He's going to bring him this religious message where he got sober. Bill was aghast. He's blown away. So that was it. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. Now I suspect a little cracked about religion. He had that starry-eyed look. Yes, the old boy was on fire, all right. But bless his heart, let him rant. Besides, my gym would last longer than his preaching. Wow. He's looking at a miracle. He's looking at a man he knows. And even with that, he says, let him preach. My drinking lasts longer than his preaching. He used to have a houseboat that lived pretty fancy boat, about 1,600 square feet of it. I had a 36-foot Owens boat to fish out of. I had new Cadillacs. I had a hard interest in an airplane. I had a little money, and I had a working wife. And man, oh man, I had a suit for every day in the week. I wore a pinky diamond ring. I had the Reno call, said, we'd sure like you to fly up. We have a plane. Sure, I would too. I lost every time I went. Anyway, but he did know Randy. They're telling you how to 12-step. You see it? They're telling you how to 12-step. All through this book, they're going to tell you every move to make. Don't rant. It made a difference what they say. In a matter-of-fact way, he told how two men had appeared in court persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. That's the story I already told you about it. They had a simple religious idea. They told them a simple religious idea, step two, and a practical program of action, 3 through 12, we call it today. That was 2 months ago. It's actually nearer to 3 when you figure out his sobriety date. And the result was self-evident. It worked. Now, he's faced with an alcoholic that he knows well. He has put it's made the automatic question, what has happened to this guy? And so he's gonna sit and listen to him. And he says, and this is 12-step work, he's come to pass his experience along to me. What is he passing? Not theory, but experience. If I cared to have it. There's 3 questions on a 12-step call. Do you think you got a problem with alcohol? No. End of 12-step call. You're done. You're not going to convince them. Alcohol's the convincer. The flamethrowers on the cheeks of my butt that brought me to you was alcohol. I didn't care to meet you. Didn't even want to know you. I thought you were the biggest losers ever walked, lived, or breathed. I didn't want to join up. But alcohol persuaded me. I was shocked but interested. Certainly I was interested. Why? He has to be, because he's run out of ideas. Just like I did. He run out of ideas. No more ideas. No more quick thinking. No more quick fixes. No more this. No more playing golf. No more I'm going to make millions of dollars. All the ideas are gone. For I was hopeless, he says. He just took step one. That's the taking of step one. He is now hopeless. And helpless to do anything about it himself. Here's how to 12-step. And Bill's going to talk about old ideas. The doctor talked about, we're going to talk about Bill's old ideas. And when we get to When we get to re-agnostic, there's a question you must ask yourself before tomorrow comes. It said we are fettered like Columbus, but the world is flat. And like the astronomical heresies of a man who was a stargazer. The people were chained to old ideas. Fettered means chained. You're going to have to ask yourself, am I chained to old ideas or am I willing to change? And I come up with all the time, I find myself with some other old idea I'm fooling with that I don't need. He talked for hours. He's 12-stepping and talking to Bill. Childhood memories rose up before me. I could almost hear the sound of the preacher's voice as I sat on still Sundays way over there on the hillside. People that went to church there used to have to go right by Grandpa's place. And they'd sit on the front porch, and as people went, and the thing wound up on the hill, and they could hear him singing. And there was a favorite oak tree. Grandpa was in the lumber business. And Bill was learned to whittle and worked with wood through lumberjacks that came down out of Canada. Grandpa got to be pretty well off and kept some of these people around for foreman. And when they bought a bunch of timber, he'd buy it standing, and then he would call these people in. They'd call the relatives. They'd come in and cut it for him. And so Bill's got a lot of information about that kind of thing. And he's thinking back on the still Sundays way over there on the hillside. There was that proffered temperance pledge I'd never signed. There was a great movement among the churches to temper the drinkers. That's impossible. They didn't know that. But just drink four. I mean, you're going to drink four, just drink two. You know. They're normal people. They don't have a clue. I can't just drink two. If I could just drink two, I wouldn't be in trouble. So it's that. That movement eventually will join and give up on us. It didn't work. So they joined the prohibitionists eventually. I never signed. My grandpa's good-natured contempt for some church folks and their doings, his insistence that the spirits really had their music, but his denial of the preacher's right to tell him how he must listen. They had a butcher who was the preacher, and he was a hypocrite. He would put his thumb on the scale and beat you out of a few ounces of meat. And Grandpa knew that, and he was a liar and a cheat. So Grandpa would laugh at him as he went by. There goes the cheat up to preach, right? Right, to tell him how he must listen. His fearlessness as he spoke of these things just before he died, he never surrendered. He stayed with it. These recollections welled up, means tears, from the past and made me swallow hard. He's fighting those tears back. The wartime days in the old Westminster Cathedral came back. I had always believed in a power greater than myself. I'd often pondered these things. I was not an atheist. But few people really are, for that means blind faith and a strange proposition that the universe originated in a cipher and aimlessly rushes nowhere. My intellectual heroes, the chemists and the astronomers, even the evolutionists, suggested vast laws and forces at work, his God. Despite contrary indications, I had little doubt there was a mighty purpose and rhythm underlaid it all. How could there be so much precise and immutable law and no intelligence? So he's forming his relationship with God. He's forming it in his mind. And a God of his understanding. I simply had to believe in the spirit of the universe, a power greater than himself. You don't want to call it God. Who knew neither time nor limitation. But that's as far as I had gone. Thank you. With the ministers and the world religions, I parted right there. When they talked of God personal to me, who was love, superhuman strength, and direction, I became irritated, and my mind snapped shut against such a theory. He's not open to the world of the Spirit. All right, let's go back now. I just wanted to cover that with you.
You had to say that before I did, huh?
Huh?
You had to say that before I did.
Is that right? Yeah. If those conditions can be met with God's help, I can tell you this, you take the steps and there's a change every time, not once in a while. I specialize in old men that come to see me that are 19 and 20 years sober. One of them is amazing, 20 years sober. Wanted to shoot himself. Very easy to find out what's going on. Okay, so I'm back on page 10 here somewhere. Where am I? Somebody remind me so I don't have to do it twice.
Bottom of the page.
Bottom of the page.
You're done. You're on top of 11.
To Christ? Okay. Old ideas. He's showing you his old thinking here. To Christ I conceded the certainty of a great man, not too closely followed by those who claimed him. His moral teachings most excellent. How many people have ever been to church here in their lifetime? Uh-huh. Got a little moral teaching, did you? Okay. For myself, I adopted those parts which seemed convenient and not too difficult. That's me. That's me. Yes, sir. Which seemed convenient, not too difficult. The rest I disregarded. You bet your sweet life. Oh, my, I could find a reason to do anything. Bill's standards, and he couldn't live up to them. He's got standards he can't live up to. I've got standards I couldn't live up to. I didn't realize why I couldn't live up to them until I got in this program. The war had been fought, burning, and chicanery is tricking. That religious disputes had facilitated made me sick. I honestly wondered whether, on balance, the religions of mankind had done any good. Judging what I'd seen in Europe and since, the power of God in human affairs was negligible, the brotherhood of man a grim jest. If there was a devil, he seemed the boss universally. He certainly had me. I got that when I was a kid at the Baptist church. If that guy, what he was talking about, if I hadn't been doing it or was thinking about doing it, I figured, I ain't got a chance in the world. I didn't know the people around me the same way. I didn't know that. Just me. Actually, what's going on has been drugged through hell. Our bottom is hell here. I'll bet you know what that means too, don't you? I have been drugged through hell. My friend sat before me and he made the point blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed. The doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Like myself, he had admitted complete defeat, step one. Then he had, in effect, been risen from the dead, step two. Suddenly taken from a scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he'd ever known. Sneaky writer, isn't it? Had this power originated in him? Obviously it had not. There had been no more power in him than there was in me at that minute, and that was none at all. He is powerless. He could not whip this thing. He has been whipped. That floored me. It began to look as though religious people were right after all. He's getting a little change here, isn't he? Under the fire of alcoholism, he's at the bottom. He's suffering. Father Ed Dowling used to say, if I ever get to heaven, it's because I'm backing away from hell. And that's about the truth. Here was something at work in a human heart which had done the impossible. My ideas about miracles were drastically revised right then. He needed one. Never mind the musty past, those old ideas. Never mind all that. Don't be chained to your past. Mine's got to change. Here sat a miracle directly across the kitchen table. He shouted great tidings. He shared his experience, strength, and hope. He is on the 12-step call. I saw that my friend was much more inwardly reorganized. He was on a different footing. His roots had grasped new soil. He's not the same guy. Despite the living example of my friend, there remained in me the vestiges of my old prejudice. About what? God. The word God still aroused a certain antipathy. When the thought was expressed there might be a God personal to me, the feeling was intensified. And as soon as Zevi started saying, God, 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 Bill said, no, no, no. I don't like that word. I have a real problem with that word. I am resentful at God when you get right down to it. I didn't like the idea. I could go for such concepts as creative intelligence. Get some intellectual stuff going on. Universal mind of spirit. I love that one. Don't you like that one? Spirit of nature. But I resisted the czars of the heaven, however loving his sway might be. Loving sway is what the girls do when they do the dance of the seven veils. Those are called sways. I've since talked with scores of men who felt the same way. Up to this time, Evie is bringing Bill a religious message from the Oxford group. This is where we change to a spiritual message in the next line. He sees he's not getting anywhere with Bill, so he changes his tack. My friend suggested what then seemed a novel idea. He said, "Why don't you choose your own conception of God?" Well, that blew him away. That nailed him. No more argument, no more fighting. That statement hit me hard. It's on step two now. See, we're moving from one to two now. It melted the icy intellectual mountains in whose shadows I'd lived and shivered many years. I used to go to bars and I just loved to drink and get into religious discussions. I have had barroom fights over God. It's amazing. I can't believe it. I stood in the sunlight at last. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required for me to make my beginning. And the beginning of the process is step three. He is preparing to take step three. Does that make sense to you? That is the beginning of the power of the process. There are a few promises in the early workings, but when you start seeing a lot of promises here, there's a ton of them, and they come in big groups. He said, I saw that growth could start from that point upon a foundation of complete willingness. There's that conditional word I just showed you in the back. Cannot be done without. God, give me the willingness to get rid of the old ideas. Let me be open to something here. I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. And when people come to Alcoholics Anonymous and they see you like I saw you when I walked in today and I heard the buzz like a beehive. I listened to the buzz when I walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's always laughter and gaiety and hugging and laughter and talking. And can you imagine? I know you know what it's like when you walk right in brand new. Scared. Don't know what you're getting into. Oh my God, it's a cult. What am I doing here? Why don't I go somewhere else? I mean, look at these people. They're not alcoholics. Look at them. And somebody gets up and tells their story and blows you away. And you go, holy crap. Oh, how could he say that? How could he say that out in public? Like, let everybody, oh no. Oh no. Of course I would. Thus, I was convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want Him enough. See, part of this deal is I got to want this God. I happen to believe, normally I'll stick right with the book, but I can tell you that I believe that we say that our meetings are autonomous and they're run by God. Autonomous meetings. They're made up by autonomous people. You have an autonomy, which means that in my case, I believe you're autonomous spirit. And what that means is you can go towards God or away from God anytime you want to. God granted you will. It's obvious. All you got to do is watch them. They can come or go as they please. There's nothing you're going to do about it. If we could fix it that way, we'd send them all to prison. They'd come out sparkly clean. That don't work. So he said, at long last, I saw, I felt, I believed. I can tell you, if you get into this thing, it's like fighting a guy can hit real hard. You either got to be in real close where he can't use his power, or you got to be all the way out. Half measures avail me nothing. So I got to be all the way in or all the way out. There's no half measure here. You'll get sicker than sick on the half measure. Scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes. A new world came into view. Oh man, look at that. So he's beginning to open up now to this spiritual experience. The real significance of my experience in the cathedral burst upon me, and for a brief moment I had needed and wanted God. You bet he did. It's easy to be brave in France. They're fighting across the water. It's easy to be brave in England, but they're fighting in France. And he's afraid. And what happens to him? There'd been a humble willingness to have him with me. And what happened to him? He came. Bill Wilson had a spiritual experience in the Westminster Cathedral long